I'd like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahroudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio Call of Islam page. This is The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim, Shia scholars and ulama all across the world of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the late Shaykh Ali Namazi Shahroudi, one of the most outstanding authors and scholars of the Shia world, who was born in Shahroud and resident in Mashhad. He is also the author of one of the most outstanding mustadraks, that is Mustadrak Safinatul Bahar. And also he's buried in the holy shrine of Imam al-Riza alayhi salam. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the early life and also the scholarly life of Sheikh Ali Namazi Shahroudi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Ali Namazi Shahroudi, being born in 1294 according to solar calendar, he is regarded as one of the pious scholars and also muhaddithin. Yes. You know, when we say muhaddith, is the type of scholars whose field of study is to talk and write and think about the hadith,
yes,
or narratives or sayings of the imams, including the prophet. That's why we see one of the huge works that he has presented to the Shia academia is called Mustadrak Safinatul Bihar.
Yes.
He is one of the scholars who started his scholarly life while he was a child next to his father, benefiting from the presence of his father. Actually, he was born in one of the southern cities of Mashhad, which is called Shahroud, almost 400 kilometers far from Mashhad. So he stayed with his father till he finished the primary studies of the seminary schools or Al-Hawza, and then he moved to Khurasan. Because if you wanted to call the seminary centers in Iran Khurasan, if it is not the first, definitely this is the second centers, specifically for the last 100 years ago. So that time we didn't have the Qom as the center, because for Qom to be a center for the Shia thoughts, the history only goes back to 100 years ago when the founder of Hawza, Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri, founded the Hawza of Qom. But almost 100 years ago, definitely by that time, Khurasan is regarded one of the main cities to have the ulama and scholars within it.
That's right.
Next to that, we had Isfahan and Ray, yes, and other cities.
That's right.
So he moved to Mashhad and benefited from the great and very knowledgeable scholars, including Mirza Mehdi Isfahani,
mm-hmm,
and benefited from the presence and knowledge of Mirza Mehdi Isfahani,
mm-hmm,
who is mainly known for his works regarding the ahadith.
Ahadith, that's right. That's all right. I think that he was, as you said, under the influence of Mirza Mehdi Isfahani and hadith-based studies. That's why he spent his lifetime, you know, on compiling Safinatul Bahar. I mean, Mustadrak Safinatul Bahar. We can say written by Muhaddith Qumi first, and after that, the Mustadrak was written by this man. Let's get to this book. I mean, Mustadrak Safinatul Bahar. First, what is Safinatul Bahar and what is Mustadrak Safinatul Bahar, Sheikh Ziyaniya?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. To understand the meaning of Safinatul Bahar, we are in need of to understanding the meaning of Bihar al-Anwar, because mm-hmm, the main book is Bihar al-Anwar.
Yes.
Bihar al-Anwar, in a sentence, we may say that is an encyclopedia that tries to collect different ahadith from a number of resources that These ahadith were scattered in these resources. So Marhum Majlisi Rahmatullah Alayhi tried to collect all these ahadith and riwayat in a single book that is consisted of 110 volumes.
Okay.
So because Bihar al-Anwar is including a number of riwayat, then we don't have a subjective, index for this book. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when somebody wants to study about the subject of knowledge or al-ilm, yes, there are some, chapters in Bihar al-Anwar talking about al-ilm, but some other riwayat are also quoted in different chapters. Safinatul Bihar is trying to collect all the riwayat that are regarding knowledge or are related or discussing the subject of knowledge or al-ilm.
Okay.
This book is trying to put them in a single chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Another important issue regarding Safinatul Bihar.
So, is this topic-based, you mean?
Yes.
It is topic-based.
So, Safinatul Bihar is topic-based.
Okay.
Another important issue is that these topics are put in order as alphabets.
Mm-hmm.
So it is started from the first letter, yes, up to the ending letter of alphabetics in Arabic. But now we want to discuss about Mustadrak Safinatul Bihar. Up,
yes,
to now we were discussing about Safinatul Bihar.
Yes.
Now Marhum Sheikh Ali Namazi, he studied Safinatul Bihar and he came to this point that, okay, there are some riwayat and some subjects that may not be, mentioned in Safinatul Bihar, but mm-hmm. they are quoted in Bihar al-Anwar.
Okay.
So he believed that these subjects and these riwayat should be also mentioned in the book of Safinatul Bihar. That's why he decided to compile the book Mustadrak Safinatul Bihar.
That's all right. So it is a completion again? You mean,
yes,
to?
Yes.
Okay.
Technically Mustadrak is referring to the books that are trying to complete
mm-hmm.
a book that is written previously.
That's right.
So we have Mustadrak Safinatul Bihar, we have Mustadrak Wasail al-Shia, we have Mustadrak Nahj al-Balagha. These means that it's a completion, and
yes,
it's trying to put those missed parts.
That's right.
Of course, according to the mindset of the second author.
That's all right. So among the scholars, a person can either refer to Bihar al-Anwar, Safinatul Bihar, or Mustadrak Safinatul Bihar, isn't it? All of them are hadith based.
Yes.
Okay. So for a researcher for hadith studies, this is,
But
this,
let me put it in this way, okay, that Mustadrak Safinatul Bihar or Safinatul Bihar, mm-hmm. they are a guidance how to use Bihar al-Anwar.
Uh-huh.
So they direct you.
Okay.
In this, Bihar al-Anwar means the oceans.
Yes, the oceans.
Of lights.
Yes.
And Safinatul Bihar means the arc that,
yes,
is, sailing on this oceans.
Yes. Okay.
So when you have an arc on these oceans, so you are able to get more benefit because now mm-hmm. you know how to, get, the benefits from these,
okay,
oceans better.
That's right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, was it only a completion? I mean, Mustadrak Safinatul Bihar, or no? There are some innovations done by Sheikh Shahruddin, Namazi Shahruddin, his book.
Before we talk about the book itself, mm-hmm. let us just complete our information regarding Sheikh Ali Namazi,
mm-hmm.
who is called as the Majlisi of his time and age, mm-hmm. by Ayatollah Mar'ashi Najafi. By Majlisi, we mean Allama Majlisi, who is the author of this voluminous, precious book, which is called Bihar al-Anwar.
Yes.
So why we have such a person, Because he himself is saying that in order to compile this book, Mustadrak Safinat al-Bihar, I read Bihar al-Anwar. Mm-hmm. I'm emphasizing on this issue that Bihar al-Anwar is not a 2, 3, 4, 5 volumes book. No, as my dear brother mentioned, 110 volumes. Mm-hmm. So he's saying that I read Bihar al-Anwar 3 times based on the ahadith in order to analyze the ahadith, the content of the ahadith, and 2 more times in order to analyze the chain of the narrators. Overall, 5 times I read such a huge, enormous book like Bihar al-Anwar. And besides that, he read the book of Allama Amini al-Ghadir, yes, which is also a very huge and voluminous book. And then he tries to present his book entitled Mustadrak Safinat al-Bihar. That's why we see, if we wanted to keep with the meaning that my brother mentioned, as the Mustadrak is the book which is going to complete, mm-hmm, or being a kind of, or playing a kind of complementary role for the main book, which is Safinat al-Bihar. In Safinat al-Bihar, for some of the letters, if you look at the content, you see, for example, for the letter Dal, yes, you have only 53 words being, yes, mentioned under this letter.
Okay.
But when you go to the Mustadrak, you see 75, mm-hmm, something like this. So again, when you add 20 letters, when you add 20 entries, it means that a huge content are going to be added to the,
okay,
main version of the book. Again, for the letter Sin, if you see something around 95 words being mentioned in Safinat al-Bihar, then when you go and refer to Mustadrak Safinat al-Bihar, mm-hmm, under the letter Sin, you see 130,
that's right,
words being compiled under this, and so on all of, okay, these letters. So this is the difference. When you, yes, look at it, good, you see the difference.
Okay.
And also, as I said, in Safinat al-Bihar, Sheikh Muhaddis Qummi, he does not say that I have compiled this based on Al-Ghadir.
Mm-hmm.
But in Mustadrak Safinat al-Bihar, we have the content of Al-Ghadir also being mentioned and, okay, organized in the book. And again, he is saying that the time that Muhaddis Qummi was compiling this Safinat al-Bihar,
okay,
he didn't have access to the complete version of some of the volumes of Bihar, that I have this access to these, oh, complete version. For example, volume 79, volume 68, mm-hmm, all of these volumes, mm-hmm, that he took his ahadith were not the completed volumes of Bihar al-Anwar at his time, that I have the that I have, yes, the free access to the complete version, that's of, right, these volumes of Bihar al-Anwar. So that when we look at this, yes, Mustadrak Safinat al-Bihar and his explanation, yes, the additional input that he, yes, has put forth, yes, in his compilation,
yes,
we see that, yes, it's worth buying this book, reading this book, and dedicating our life to benefit from this book.
So Sheikh Namazi Shahroudi was not only concerned about the resources of the old versions, but the contemporary researchers that were done at his time. He was also concerned with them too.
Yeah,
okay,
for sure.
That's all right. So what would be the benefit, of using such a book? Can the public, for example, use it or no? Only the scholars might be able to use it. The Mustadrak.
Yes, we have to say that maybe public, or let me say, ordinary people may not get most benefit from Bihar al-Anwar, mm-hmm, because, finding some, subjects may be difficult for them.
Mm-hmm.
But Safinat al-Bihar and Mustadrak Safinat al-Bihar, these two books are trying to, make the process of usage of Bihar al-Anwar easier for people.
Okay.
But again, we should have this in our mind that, studying hadith is a subject that needs some, expertise in some fields.
Yes.
So it's like some people want to study, for example, a medicine book that, yes, is containing technical words. The book of Hadith is exactly like this, especially about Bahar al-Anwar. We should say that there are some points about Riwayat that, you know, they are in need of, you know, let me say, experience of dealing with Riwayat, yes. And, you know, okay. Learning from teachers how to, yes, understand a Hadith correctly, okay, and what is the chain of narrators and... you know, these, you know, technical terms.
That's right.
But putting all these aside, we should know that studying a hadith itself is a virtue, mm-hmm, is a good action. And Safinatul Bihar and Mustadrak Safinatul Bihar are the books that are assisting ordinary people and scholars and, yes, researchers,
that's right,
to get benefit from Riwayat easier and faster.
That's all right. Also for the non-Shias who want to be familiar with these precious sayings and the words of the Ahlul Bayt, I think these mustadraks are easy to understand and easy to refer to because they are topic-based, you know. They can refer to and so much benefit, you know, something which is missed. And I think it's a gap maybe among the non-Shias inside the Islamic lands in order to benefit from the wordings and the words of the Ahlul Bayt, these precious, because the sayings and the statements. Okay, that's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziyanian, Sheikh Mahtavi, Sheikh Ali Namazi Shahrudi passed away on Zilhijjah 2nd, 1405, according to the lunar Hijri calendar in the city of Mashhad, and he was buried in one of the chambers of Sahne Noor, Sahne Azadi, Azadi courtyard of the Holy Shrine of Imam al-Raza alayhi salam in the city of Mashhad. May Allah bless his soul. The answer of Mustadrak Safinatul Bihar. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. The another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
In the limelight. With the increase in the prices of gas, electricity, gasoline, and the intensifying inflationary pressure on the consumers, one out of every six American households is unable to pay their electricity bills. Most Americans do not accept President Joe Biden's explanation for the higher prices of gasoline and fuel, and say he has performed poorly in managing the U.S. economy in general. The U.S. President Joe Biden claims that Russia is responsible for the increase in the price of oil and gas, but a new opinion poll shows that only 1 in 10 Americans, or about 11%, agree with this explanation. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the U.S. media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The New York Times reports, gas, electricity, and gasoline prices in the United States are creeping higher, reversing a months-long streak of declines and chipping away at a potent talking point for the Joe Biden administration, which has been emphasizing its success at easing pressure on the American public since this summer. Though the uptick has followed a rise in crude oil prices, analysts point out to two new factors that are also pushing gas and gasoline prices higher: a loss of refining capacity in California and Ohio, and rising demand in recent weeks. According to data from the American Automobile Association, the AAA, the national average price of regular gasoline stood at $3.89 a gallon on Friday, 7th of October, climbing for more than 2 weeks. That's lower than the record of about $5.02 a gallon reached in June of this year, but still higher than usual for this time of the year. Prices have made a particularly big leap in California. At about $6.39 a gallon, prices are close to the state's June record of $6.44 a gallon. Gas prices there and in other western states, including in Nevada and Arizona, jumped after several refineries in the region closed for maintenance. The rise, should it last, could increase pressure on the White House to act quickly to bring down prices. A spike in gas prices, which followed a surge in crude oil and other energy costs after Russia's conflict with Ukraine, became both a political liability and a policy headache as consumer prices rose across the board. President Joe Biden, who over the summer responded to the increase in gas prices by chiding energy companies for profiteering on consumers, released oil from strategic reserves and encouraged Saudi Arabia to produce more oil. Gas prices eventually started to decline. The global oil prices tumbled amid rising concern about the slowing of global economy and demand eased. The recent jump means White House officials have been pressed to address the issue once again. Brian Deas, the director of the National Economic Council, said on Thursday, 6th of October, that energy companies need to lower prices at the petrol pump. Analysts say the refinery shutdowns will be temporary, and the fact that Americans tend to drive less in the winter months could keep prices from climbing as sharply as they did back in June. But a recent rebound in crude oil prices, which rose nearly 17% this week as the world's major oil producers agreed to cut production, means predicting what's next will be difficult. The Hill has covered the same story, but from a different angle. According to a Gallup poll released recently, the American public's view of the economy are declining as gas prices are rising. 2/3 of the American public surveyed in the poll conducted recently said that gas prices are causing a moderate or severe financial hardship on their household. That figure marks an increase of 15 percentage points from the 52% who said the same back in April, and is among the highest that Gallup has found when posing the question during periods of gas price increases since 2000. Meanwhile, Gallup's Economic Confidence Index, a summary of Americans' ratings of current economic conditions and outlook for the economy's future, dropped 13 percentage points from last month to minus 58. The index ranges from 100 if all respondents describe the economy positively to minus 100 if all respondents describe the economy negatively. The index's current score is the lowest since February of 2009, when the country was still experiencing the Great Recession. The all-time low was minus 72, recorded back in October of 2008. 8 out of 10 surveyed adults in households earning less than $40,000 a year said gas prices have caused a financial hardship, and 4 out of 10 describe it as severe. Almost 3/4 of respondents from the households earning between $40,000 and $99,999 reported a hardship, and 40% called it severe. Half of respondents from households earning more than $100,000 a year reported a hardship, and 22% called it severe. Aside from the political consequences, a sustained rise in gas prices could affect how businesses and consumers view the U.S. economy. In July, falling gas prices were a key part of the better-than-expected reading of the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, offering a brief glimmer of hope to those looking for signs that inflation has peaked. Russia Today has also covered the same story. According to a Rasmussen poll published recently, just 11% of the American public believe Russian President Vladimir Putin is to blame for record high gas prices in the United States. The majority instead blame President Joe Biden. More than half, or 52% of respondents to the Rasmussen poll conducted recently, pointed to President Biden's poor energy policies as the reason gas prices have become unaffordable, meaning the administration's Putin's price hike narrative does not appear to be catching on. Those who blame neither Joe Biden nor Vladimir Putin point their fingers at oil companies, with 29% of respondents suggesting the industry is leveraging the current geopolitical instability to jack up its prices. Perhaps aware that his Putin's price hike narrative no longer holds water, Joe Biden has been leaning towards blaming oil and gas companies for the ruinous cost of fueling up, recently accusing the industry of making more money than God. President Biden has insisted that oil companies are deliberately holding back from drilling because they make more money not producing more oil. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen recently warned that gas prices may spike again this winter. In an interview with CNN, Janet Yellen said gas prices could rise due to the European Union largely halting Russian oil purchases this winter and banning provision of services that allow Russia to ship oil by tanker. Janet Yellen said it is possible that could cause a spike in oil prices. The price of gas is widely viewed as a critical issue heading into the midterm elections this November. Some 92% of voters saw the rising price of gas, home heating oil, and other fuels as a serious problem in recent opinion poll, with 68% of the American public calling the problem very serious. With no sign of an economic turnaround and elections coming this November, the Democratic Party is likely to be blamed for voters' economic suffering, and both houses of Congress may end up under Republican control.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws about medical issues and conditions according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography and we'll be back. Don't go away.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the medical issues and the laws about them, Islamic laws, according to the fatwas of Ayatollah Khomeini, I would like to ask you this question. This is something that we've been talking about, some of the methods of contraception before in the previous programs, but now I would like to ask you about the abortion, you know. Is it permissible according to Islamic laws to have an abortion because of reasons such as, for example, economic flights?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Generally speaking, it is not permissible for a couple to go for abortion, to choose to abort to terminate the pregnancy or to abort a child at any stage of the conception. Let's say, for example, that the woman has conceived and it is only 1 week that she has conceived a child. It's not permissible. If there is no, for example, hardship, unbearable hardship, or any problem that is intolerable, it is not permissible to abort the child. Now, when it comes to economic problems, of course, it is not permissible under any circumstances to have an abortion because the Quran actually says, "La taqtul awladakum khashyat imlaq." Okay, do not kill your children for fear of hunger or you know, starvation.
Yes,
the Quran is very clear when it comes to having abortion or killing a child. You know,
right.
And of course, when a child is conceived, that is a child, even if that child is not born yet, but it's not forbidden to abort the child at any stage of pregnancy. Of course, there are exceptions, but when it comes to economic problems, the couple is healthy and there's no problem other than the economic problem.
Right.
Of course, it's not permissible under any circumstances, even when there are fear of shortage of food or something like that. You know, financial support, maybe the father is very much afraid or anxious or worried about how to provide for the child. Of course, such concerns are irrelevant. And, if there is someone who has this worry and who worries about how to, you know, support the family or the child, of course, this kind of worry suggests that he does not have confidence and trust in Allah.
Mm-hmm.
Because if a person is confident and trusts God, God himself promises that he himself will provide for the child.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's not the father, it's it's Allah himself
who is the sustainer.
Yeah, who is the sustainer, sure.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue along the same lines of these questions about the Islamic laws related to the medical issues. In this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javed. As always, we are talking about some of the Islamic laws related to the medical issues. Well, Sheikh Javed, let me ask you this question, because this is also a prevalent kind of question, and these scenarios that we face today in this life, in this day and age. In the early months of her pregnancy, the doctor told the mother that continuing with the pregnancy might pose a danger to her life, or in other words, endanger her life.
Sure.
He further advised the doctor that the baby might be born or would be born deformed, right?
Yes.
In the light of the doctor's findings, the doctor advised the mother to have an abortion. Is this course of action permissible according to the Islamic laws? And is it permissible to terminate the pregnancy before the soul, of course, before the soul enters the body of the fetus?
Well, I got your question, and I learned that, of course, the reason for having abortion is the deformity problem. Some children are born deformed, and of course, having a deformed baby, according to Islamic Sharia, is not a valid or a legal reason to terminate the pregnancy. Of course, that the couple are unfortunate because of the fact that they are going to have a deformed baby in the future. But deformity is not a valid excuse for terminating the pregnancy, even if the soul has not yet entered the child, the fetus, okay? Mm. It's not permissible to abort that child. But when it comes to danger, of course, danger, if the life, the mother's life, is endangered because of carrying the baby or because of being pregnant with the child, of course, she can have abortion to protect herself, to save her life, because the mother's life is more important than that of the child. And of course, there is no objection to her aborting the fetus prior to the soul entering the fetus. That's very important, because when the soul enters the fetus, or when the soul is infused into the according to the Quranic term, which says the soul is whispered into the fetus. That's the term. Of course, in that case, it's not permissible, because the child is alive, okay? And it's not permissible to have abortion when the child has is alive and its heart is beating and the soul has entered it. And of course, in that case, there are other scenarios which the parents or the couple should see and go through.
Uh-huh. But regarding the deformity, the intellect tells us that it's illogical, not only not economical actually, to raise a child which is deformed, because both economically speaking and also reasonably, it's not logical actually to raise a child which is deformed, but not only for the parents but also for the child, the very child himself or herself, because deformities might threaten somehow his or her existence in today's life. But regarding that, there is this interesting question about the deformity I would like to ask you. With the help of modern technology, the doctors can now identify the congenital deformities of the fetus during pregnancy, right? Yes. Because of the difficulties babies born with deformities facing today's life, is it permissible to terminate the pregnancy if it is found by a reliable specialist, of course, that the fetus has developed any deformity?
Okay. First of all, I would like to say that, deformity is deformity. But, there are different degrees of deformity. And whatever the degree, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, it is not permissible to abort the fetus at any stage for the mere reason that the fetus is deformed. The answer is clear. And it's also not permissible for the couple or for the wife to abort the fetus for future difficulties that the child is going to encounter, because a deformed child will definitely encounter lots of problems. For example, if the child does not have an eye, or if he does not have, a limb. So definitely he will encounter problems. He will not live like an ordinary or a regular individual. So as a deformed child, he will be ostracized or marginalized in the society, and he will not benefit from the advantages other people do. So, but that is not an excuse, and that's not a valid reason for abortion.
I see. Thank you very much, Javid, for your answers to these questions of Islamic laws related to the medical issues in this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Congratulations to all our IRIB listeners on the occasion of 17th of Rabiul Awal, the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. To today is in fact a day of double celebration. We celebrate the birth anniversary of the sixth infallible successor of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners on this very auspicious occasion.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
French leaders have seemingly found a solution to the country's energy crisis. Puffer jackets and turtlenecks have become the newest fashion trend in the Élysée, as ministers and the president try to imply a message to the public: wrap up warm for winter. That's while, as the cold season approaches, the nation struggles to afford heating. French motorists have been made to wait in long lines across the country to refuel their vehicles as petrol pumps run dry amid ongoing strikes at the country's oil refineries and storage sites. Almost a third of the petrol stations had problems getting deliveries of fuel as tanker drivers continue their strike over low wages and harsh working conditions amid a cost-of-living crisis in France. So, to cut the long story short, Macron is up to his neck in trouble, and his government's winter wardrobe messaging has drawn accusations of being out of touch with everyday reality. The country's far-right opposition leader, Marine Le Pen, mocked the government saying, "Don't have enough heating? Let them wear cashmere." And Gaspard Ganser, an advisor to former President François Hollande, labeled the idea grotesque and paternalistic. Paris has come up with an energy efficiency plan to get through the winter without blackouts. Homes and offices heated to a maximum of 19 Celsius degrees. No hot water in public buildings, no lit advertising overnight, a ban on doors left open in heated or air-conditioned shops, reduced temperatures in swimming pools and gyms. These are some examples of the action France is taking to save energy. However, environmentalists have accused the French government of promoting tiny measures while failing to take enough action on the climate crisis. They say unenforced and voluntary measures are ineffective. Also, scores of French intellectuals have urged the nation to rise in protest against President Emmanuel Macron's failure to improve economic conditions amid rising inflation. The current situation troubles the French government as a foretaste of problems to come, a potential winter of discontent. Now, the question is, will Macron get his head out of his turtleneck? Thousands of demonstrators gathered in Paris to protest soaring inflation and high cost of living, demanding that France pull out completely from membership in the US-led NATO military alliance. They demanded that President Emmanuel Macron resign, calling on his government to stop supplying arms to Ukraine. Ever since the Ukrainian crisis began, causing a severe energy crisis across Europe, anti-NATO sentiments have been rising among Europeans. Similar protests have been held across the European Union against soaring inflation and the rising cost of living caused by sanctions imposed on Russia in the wake of the Ukraine war. Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine in late February, Western countries have slapped waves of sanctions on Russia. In response, Moscow has either choked up or lessened its gas exports to the rest of Europe, saying it would only resume the gas flow after the economic sanctions were lifted. Disruption in supply chains has led to higher fuel and food prices across the EU, driving inflation to record levels and causing the cost of living to soar. The European Union leaders accused the Kremlin of wielding energy as a weapon, cutting gas supplies in retaliation for sanctions. The protesters also called on the US-led NATO coalition to immediately stop supplying arms to Ukraine and to work to resolve the simmering crisis through diplomacy.
I have three priorities for our economy. Growth, growth, and growth.
Flip-flopping and humiliating U-turn are the terms used by members of parliament and various media outlets on Liz Truss's 180 on her 45% tax cut for the rich. Truss and her chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng thought that a tax cut for the rich would create more jobs and then eventually lead up to tax cuts for the general public as a part of her trickle-down economic plans in what is being referred to in the media as mini-budget.
How is that fair that you get a tax cut of over 2,000 while people on average income see much less?
So everybody is getting a tax cut, and the situation that we were in was we were putting up taxes. That was the immediate situation that we were in. We were facing a situation where the tax burden was at a 70-year high, and that was completely unacceptable. The Prime Minister campaigned for the leadership on the basis that we were going to reduce taxes, and that's exactly what we've done.
Truss and Kwarteng were quickly forced to turn back on their decision as the plan was received very poorly by Truss's own Tory party, who threatened to vote against the tax cuts.
I don't comment on market movements, but what is good for the economy?
Who caused it?
What is good for the economy?
The tax cuts would have been the largest set of unfunded tax cuts for the rich in over 50 years and a huge gamble on public finances and the health of UK economy, according to Welsh Finance Minister Rebecca Evans. When the news broke out about her tax cut plans, the British pound hit a record low against the dollar, prompting a $73 billion budget allocation by Bank of England to shore up the markets before the pound partially recovered. The British Premier, however, blamed communication errors in how the package was presented, and some communication error that was, the kind that shocked markets and voters and couldn't get her the support she needed by her own Conservative Party before she had to back off on it. The controversy in her economic plan comes after the worst start to a new administration in recent memory in the UK, with people already questioning how long Britain's new Prime Minister will remain in office. One might even say trust is fading in Truss. The UK's GDP growth has been on a slow but steady decline since 2014, from 1% down to 0%. It was the pandemic, however, that completely flatlined the UK economy, causing the single biggest slump in its GDP since its GDP was recorded in 1961. By extension, according to the Office for National Statistics, the UK consumer price inflation hit just over 10% in the 12 months to July. That is the highest inflation rate in the country since the early 80s. Things aren't much different outside the UK, across the Green Continent. Certainly, the pandemic caused its own set of problems for European economy, but perhaps it was the Ukraine war and the subsequent food and energy crisis that really cemented Europe's ongoing and expected economic downturn. Drastic plans to manage the crisis is being implemented across Europe. 3-hour power cuts to homes and businesses are expected during this winter in the UK. Germany rationed hot water, dimmed streetlights, and shut down swimming pools. French people are using more and more wood and less gas to heat their homes. Buildings in Italy will have 15 extra days without central heating. This all begs the question, is the insistence of the West on prolonging the Ukraine war really worth the damages it is causing their economy and their people?
In the mid-90s, the US was involved in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, but that was a nuclear arms race.
Now, however, Washington is fighting another Cold War, with China this time, and in the digital space, a fight for technological superiority. In late August 2022, Washington restricted sales of high-end and sophisticated chips to China and Russia. Top chip designers based in the US have even reported that they have been told to limit sales of their high-end chips. One of the manufacturers, NVIDIA, one of the largest graphical process unit makers in the world, has even revealed through an SEC filing that Washington fears there is a risk that the products may be used militarily in China and Russia. The US says the restrictions are aimed at keeping advanced technologies out of the wrong hands. Meanwhile, China has slammed the restrictions, stating that the US is trying to impose a technological blockade. Beijing added that Washington aims to maintain its technological hegemony through the latest restrictions. The latest round of tensions between China and the US could also present an explanation for Washington's increasing interest in Taiwan. The Biden administration has so far tried to further strengthen its ties with Taiwan, and this has been clearly demonstrated in many cases, the two most notable being top US officials traveling there and Washington offering billions in subsidies to a Taiwanese company if it stops selling its advanced semiconductor chips to China. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, or TSMC, is the largest and most advanced chip manufacturing factory in the world. And Biden's push to stop the sales to Beijing only proves the US's aims that it seeks to impose a technological blockade and maintain or even strengthen its hegemony. The host of measures that Washington is taking to stop Beijing from getting its hands on high-end technology could amount to the biggest shift in US policy on shipping technology to China since the 1990s. The expansion of US powers to control exports of chips made with US tools to China is based on a broadening of the so-called Foreign Direct Product Rule. This is the same principle that gave the US authority to control the export of chips made overseas to Chinese telecoms giant Huawei Technologies, and later to stop the flow of semiconductors to Russia. But the question is whether this will be effective or will it backfire, similar to many other unilateral measures that the US has taken over the past years. Some experts say Washington's move will set the Chinese back. But some, including top American officials in the US, say the unilateral controls being put into place will lose effectiveness over time, and the effort could backfire if other countries don't join Washington. The most recent US blockade is aimed at preventing technology from being used by America's military rival. But these chips have a wide range of applications. Even if the blockade ends up being as effective as the US wants it to be, it is only a matter of time before China begins manufacturing its own high-end chipsets, as well as semiconductors, and eventually becoming self-reliant. It started in February 2022, and there seems to be no end in sight. While the Ukrainian military has made some advances, Russia still controls some 20% of the country, and there's nothing that suggests that this war is winding down. The Ukrainian military is backed up by Western weapons and Western intelligence gathering, which tells them where Russian soldiers are and where their bases are located. In the latest in its long list of support for Ukraine, the US Congress has passed another aid for Kiev, which amounts to some $12 billion. And this is on top of nearly $50 billion sent there in the past year. But apart from all the weapons, cash, and intelligence sent and given to Ukraine, reports are emerging that the US has sent men on the ground there. A recent report released by an American news organization
The Intercept stated that the U.S. Special Operations Forces are on the ground in Ukraine as part of a broad covert operation that includes CIA personnel.